Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Lynn Wilson. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Wilson is a professor of therapeutic radiology and an expert in the use of radiation to treat lung cancers and cutaneous lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, Francine is joined by Dr. Tongzhen Zhang. Dr. Zhang is professor of epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health, and he joins us this evening for a conversation about the epidemiology of cancer. Here's Francine Foss.
Could you start us off by just defining for our audience what is epidemiology? A tough question.
That's really hard. Epidemiology, when we call epidemiology, we're really different from clinicians. And the clinical works. What epidemiologists do is to study how the diseases distributed among the population. And so we're called study the distribution of the disease. Once we identify how the disease distributed, we must ask ourselves why the disease distributed this way. So we study the determinants of the distribution. That's what epidemiologists do, and we call it epidemiology.
What are those determinants, for instance? What kinds of things do you look at?
That depends on diseases. And for example, if you find out a disease increasing or decreasing with unknown reasons, you don't know why that's the case. So you have to start it to study, to create your hypothesis. We call it generating the study hypothesis. And then we launch the study. For example, when we, in the 1990s, we find out non-Hodgkin's lymphoma has been increasing in the United States, actually worldwide. So we ask the question, why this disease has been increasing? When we find out breast cancer has been increasing in the United States, we will ask ourselves, is this increase is real or is artificial, such as just because more being detected through mammography screening?
So a lot of this depends on use of these kind of SEER databases and these cancer registries. So to what degree is that information reliable for your studies?
Well, you asked a wonderful question. Actually, when I graduated from Harvard in 1990, I came to Yale. I started looking at the data from Connecticut Tumor Registry. Why I do that? Because what I was really interested in, I wanted to know what kind of diseases are increasing, why they are increasing this way. So actually the SEER data, which cover almost 10% of the United States population and extremely valuable, like a Connecticut Tumor Registry data after I came here in 1990, between 1990 to 1996, we published almost 20 publications examining many, many cancer for their time and trends. Actually, we find a very important information which we bring tremendous amount of money for doing the research. For example, we first find out non-Hodgkin's lymphoma has been increasing in Connecticut. This very quickly confirmed by many other sites. Actually, by 1992, NCI organized a worldwide meeting called the Epidemic of Non-Hodgkin's Lymphoma, and then we received the grants. By 1995, we find the Hodgkin's disease has been increasing, which particularly among younger people, especially among women. So we got another grant from the NCI. And then we find the testicular cancer has been increasing in Connecticut, because the Connecticut Tumor Registry started in 1935.
It is the oldest one in the United States?
Almost in the world.
In the world?
Yeah. And, we have, Connecticut, some very uniqueness about the cancer registration. You know, Yale New Haven Hospital, they have a tumor registry, hospital tumor registry. That's the world's oldest hospital-based registry for cancer registration. And the Connecticut Tumor Registry is the oldest at the state level. or provincial level in the world. So they provide very valuable information for us.
So just so the audience understands that what happens in Connecticut is that if you go to any hospital and you have a diagnosis of cancer because you've had a biopsy of any kind, all of that information is captured at the level of the state. Is that correct?
Yeah. We have two ways to register cancer patients. One is called a passive. Passive means you rely on the physicians or lab to report to the government. Another way to register called active, which means we send the people to the pathology department, to the hospital to identify the patients. So Connecticut now we have actually not only have actively reporting, we also have a called rapid case ascertainment system, which is located at Yale.
And what is that?
That means once a patient's diagnosed with a cancer, the Yale Cancer Center, the rapid case ascertainment, they will send the people to the hospital and every day, and send the copy of the information and send it back to the cancer center, and then with data entry into the computer, at the end of the year, we compare with the Connecticut Tumor Registry data and then see if we lose any patients. So it's a very good system in Connecticut for cancer registration.
So, Tongzeng, you've told us about increased incidence of cancer, particularly lymphomas and testicular cancer in Connecticut. Well, certainly that's something that I think should worry all of us. But can you tell us what some of the causes for that might be and what kind of research you've done to look at that?
Yeah. For non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, we started 1995 in Connecticut. We looked at because we know that the genes didn't change much. You cannot suddenly change the gene to cause the disease increase. So that there must be something in our environment. So when I say environment, it's a much broader mean. It's not just air, water, soil, include lifestyle and many other factors. So we, in 1992, actually I and some other colleagues, we proposed sun exposure, heavy sun exposure, increased the risk of non-Hodgkin lymphoma. So this is one of the factors we looked for. And another factor is the pesticides. We looked for all kinds of pesticides, no matter herbicides and insecticides. And also we looked for hair dye use. And because these factors have been suspected, of course, other lifestyle factors, such as smoking, drinking, diet. So we looked through a lot of factors for the potential relationship between these exposures and the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma risk in the population.
So what made you think that the sun exposure might be associated with lymphoma?
that's a very good question, very tough questions. Actually, when you generate a hypothesis, you really, no matter so-called inductive or deductive, but you have to have some basic observations. And we also have to be supported by some lab results. So in the 1990s, when we found out non-Hodgkin lymphoma has been increasing, we find at the same time, non-Hodgkin lymphoma has been increasing in parallel with the malignant melanoma, the skin cancer. And some studies suggested when you had skin cancer, you had increased risk of non-Hodgkin lymphoma. If you had a non-Hodgkin lymphoma, you have increased risk for skin cancer. And also, when we find that people had an organ transplant, they have increased risk for skin cancer. So one of the really factors related to non-Hodgkin lymphoma is immune suppression. So we know heavy exposure to sun, you can cause immune suppression. So all these things put together, we thought, wow, this must be one of the factors we should suspect. So,
and can you talk about the chemical exposure? That's obviously something that a lot of people are worried about out there. How does a person know if they've been exposed to these chemicals, and how do you actually test that, you know, in your studies? How do you actually determine that?
Yeah, there's two types of chemicals. One is something we know, We know whether we exposure to. For example, if you work in the gas station, you know you exposure to benzene, yeah, because of smell and the job exposure. Another, if you are a pathologist, you know your exposure to formaldehyde. So some of the things you know, but some other factors you may not know. For example, we call it organochlorines, such as PCBs. It's a kind of industrial fire retardants. So we examine thousands of person in Connecticut and in other populations. There's no one you're immune from exposure to pathogens, but PCBs. So some of the chemicals you exposure to, you know, some you do not know. So when we measure the exposure, we have two ways. One is we by the so-called observational methods through questionnaire interview and ask you the job exposure, your history, or what you intake through food. Because we know these kind of so-called organochlorines, they are fat soluble. And if you eat a lot of fat meat, if you eat a fish, because the accumulate the fish spring. So we know you have a higher exposure. So, and another way, like we study breast cancer and organochlorines exposure, we take breast tissue, fat tissue, because they are fat soluble. We also take the blood and measure the blood level, these kind of chemicals. So there are many ways to assess human exposure to chemicals.
You had done some very, very interesting work that really changed, I think, behavior in the United States, and that was the hair dye, the so-called hair dye study.
Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So in 1995, we started with a hair dye exposure and a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma risk. So when we collect the information about the hair dye exposure, we had studied about 600 women who have been diagnosed with non-Hodgkin lymphoma. We have 700 women who are normal, which is healthy. We asked them whether you use a hair dye, what type of hair dye you use, what color you use, what period you started to use, what age you started to use. And by once we asked all these detailed information, and then we compare people had being diagnosed with a non-Hodgkin lymphoma and the people are healthy. We found people who used darker hair dye and especially used a long time period, like more than 20, 25 years, and especially for women started before 1980, they have an increased risk of non-Hodgkin lymphoma. When the study was published first and the Europeans, they have a parallel study, they immediately repeat our results. And also California, they also have a study. They also seems confirmed our observation, which means people started to use hair dye before 1980, use a long period with a darker hair dyes that have increased the risk of non-Hodgkin lymphoma.
So I understand that as a result of your study, they changed the formulation of that hair dye. Is that correct?
And the reason the people started, why we find that the risk mainly among people started before 1980 is because in the 1980s, the NCI scientists did a lot of research. They found some components in the hair dye products contain mutagens and the potential carcinogens. So since that time period, the hair dye company has been working very hard trying to eliminate potential carcinogens. They indeed did a very hard work for the hair dye company.
That's really an amazing story. Yeah. I'd like to talk to you a little bit more when we come back from the Medical Minute. Please stay tuned to learn more about cancer epidemiology with Dr. Tang Zhang Zhang.
The American Cancer Society estimates that last year there were over 65,000 new cases of melanoma in this country, and over 1,000 patients are diagnosed annually in Connecticut alone. While melanoma accounts for only about 4% of skin cancer cases, it causes the most skin cancer deaths. Early detection is the key. When detected early, melanoma is easily treated and highly curable. And new treatment options and surgical techniques are giving melanoma survivors more hope than they've ever had before. Clinical trials are currently underway at Yale Cancer Center, Connecticut's federally designated comprehensive cancer center, to test innovative new treatments for melanoma. The specialized programs of Research Excellence in Skin Cancer grant at Yale, also known as the SPOR grant, will help establish national guidelines on modifying behavior and on prevention, as well as identification of new drug targets. This has been a Medical Minute, brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Francine Foss, and I'm joined today by Dr. Tongzeng Zhang, and we're here discussing the epidemiology of cancer. We just heard in the first part of the show, Tongzeng, about the increased incidence of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in Connecticut. Are there other cancers where there's a strong link between the environment or various kinds of exposures and the increased incidence of that particular cancer other than lymphoma?
Yeah, this depends on the countries and depends on where do you live. For example, in the United States, we have a few where we did a tremendous work for both cancer epidemiologists and the clinicians, and we call it prevention and control, but still have some cancer increasing. Let me give you two examples in the United States. One is the liver cancer, which used to be very rare in the United States, but now they should increase in. But some people suspect it's about hepatitis C and hepatitis B, but we just feel this story, this virus story, cannot explain everything. Another cancer which is also increasing is thyroid cancer, and actually one of my colleagues, Dr. Ya Wei Zhan, last year she proposed maybe the industrial pollutants such as the PBDE exposure may be responsible for the increased risk of thyroid cancer. So that's in the United States. And then you see the world picture. For example, because we are talking about environmental exposure, it's just so clearly many diseases are associated with the environmental exposure. For example, in China. Because during the past 30 years, China's economic development brings tremendous wealth to the people. But at the same time, the environmental deteriorated very rapidly. As the environmental change, and there's created many so-called cancer village. One village after the village, that many, many people are being diagnosed with a cancer. So, and you carefully look at their environment. They're adjacent to some industry, and the industry release air or release the water into their drinking system. So it's clearly some of the environmental factors related to the disease increasing. You, for example, if you say the border between Iran, China, and Russia, the esophageal cancer is very high. On the other hand, if you say Denmark, Switzerland, and many Western societies we quote, testicular cancer has been increasing rapidly for no reason. And actually, this testicular cancer, I just personally feel, should bring a breakthrough. Because if you see the white population, they show tremendous population variation. Like Denmark, Switzerland, they have the highest testicular cancer rates. And then you check out United States, Britain, Greater Britain, and France, Canada, the moderate rates. But if you see the black population, or we see in the United States, you see the African-Americans, in reality, the black population, no matter where do you live, and no matter what time period, from 1930s until now, they almost have the same rates. So there's no change by time, there's no change by population or geographical area, but the white population should have tremendous population variation. And in Connecticut, the rates has been increasing rapidly, just keep increasing from 1930s until 2007. So this definitely shows a tremendous environmental impact, but at the same time, show the geographic variation. This indicate what? Indicate genetics may modify the environmental exposure for different population risk.
So that's been a big part of the work of your group, I understand, which is to actually look at the genetics of the individual and look at genes that might be associated with the development of cancer or phenotype, so to speak, that would be development associated with the development of cancer.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that for our audience? Explain what that is and what is the work that you're doing?
Yeah. For example, when we talk about environmental exposure and human health, the general public always ask a question. For example, I'm smoking, I'm fine, I did not get any cancer, and I drinking, I do not have hypertension. So people always ask these questions. So before 1990s, we focus on lifestyle factors. So we just use questionnaire, ask people whether you're smoking and drinking. By the later 1990s, we find that that's not enough. Because obviously, no matter environmental and lifestyle factors, exposure, we see them carcinogens. But many people exposure to carcinogens, they do not have increased risk of cancer. So this clearly indicate some genetic background we carry, either protect us or either make us more susceptible. So by the later 1990s, we started to study the genes and their relationship with the environmental and how they affect the human disease risks. So we call it gene-environmental interaction. By the 2000s, by the 2000, 2001, that time, an epidemiologist or the cancer investigators were no longer satisfied to only study individual genes. So we studied by so-called pathway genes. So, for example, metabolism pathway gene and DNA repair gene. And by the later 2000, 2006, 2007, 2008, we started called GVAX, means the entire genome analysis. By doing this, one side, you can identify specific gene or genotype, which may be responsible for high risk of disease. At the same time, you can also find out and what type of genotype, or polymorphism we call it, and they can protect people. And what kind of genotype, they may increase the risk of human disease. So this is what we're doing now. We're doing the breast cancer, and by participate with called the international consortium. We have the Breast Cancer Consortium, International Consortium. We have the Non-Hodgkin Lymphoma International Consortium, Hodgkin's Disease. Now we're just forming another called the Testicular Cancer International Consortium. By combining these studies together, we have more population samples. So we can really look into detail about genotype, environmental, and human exposure.
So Tongzhen, can you just tell our audience, in terms of the scale of this, how many patients are involved in those big studies, and how many genes are you actually looking at?
Like for example, the non-Hodgkin lymphoma, I just use this one as an example. We formed an international lymphoma consortium called Interlim. We almost involve 15,000 people, and actually still expanding, could reach 20,000 people, which include cases and the controls. We use the National Cancer Institute, their gene lab. We analyze, now it's not just one or two genes, the entire, we call it GVAX, genome-wide association study, thousands SNPs, or hundreds of thousands of SNPs. Analyzed, and the challenge for us is now, you have all this data, how you are going to analyze them, how you are going to analyze, identify them, which one is a high-risk gene or genotype, which one is actually modified with an environmental exposure.
When you have this information, how do you see that that's going to then translate into something different that we're going to be doing in the clinic? The tough question.
That's a really, really tough question, because one time I was talking to my neighbor. He said, what are you doing? I told her about this. She asked me, so if I have this gene, what are you going to do with me? I said, that's very tough. For environmental epidemiologists at this stage, what we are focused is why this disease are affected by environmental exposure, why some people did not affected by the environmental exposure at this stage. For example, if you do not study the relationship between environmental and the gene and the disease risk, you may not be able to even see the relationship between environmental exposure and disease. For example, if you only study testicular cancer among black population, you will find that they're fine. That's for the past 70 years, the disease risk is no, they did not increase. But if we started by different population which carry different genetic background, for example, in the white population, in Asia population, we find a totally different story. And some population increases so rapidly and showed a tremendous susceptibility to the environmental exposure. So how to translate what we observed in epidemiology study to clinical use? And there's another step, because this will involve very sensitive ethnic issues. And for example, if I have this background, should I go to check out? Should I do a screening? And if I screen it, will this affect my life? So this will be new for the gradually the scientists, and will figure out what exactly useful. But most important for epidemiologists, we must find out how human exposure to environment gut disease, how they are affected, why this disease express in some people but did not express in other people.
So Tongzhen, you've done a lot of work in China. And can you tell us what you've been doing in China and how the Chinese experience compares to ours? And clearly they have a higher incidence of some of these cancers related to the environmental exposures. What are you learning in China?
Yeah, we have two types of research. One is part of a study we already finished, and some of the study are just ongoing. The study we finished for my my group involved is like a breast cancer study and childhood asthma study. This we finished. The ongoing study, we actually a very exciting program in China. One is the liver cancer study. You know, China has the highest liver cancer in the world. The world diagnose 100 liver cancer patients a year, China would have 50. So China has a very high liver cancer. Yeah. Another one is the birth cohort. We are building the birth cohort study in China, which will study so-called prenatal exposure and human diseases.
Dr. Tongzhen Zhang is professor of epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health. If you have questions or would like to share your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.